Hello there. It is Thursday, June the 2nd. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, there could be a break in the search for Egypt Air black boxes. Hillary Clinton seizes on complaints about Donald Trump's now defunct real estate seminars. President Obama moves to dispel what he says are myths about his economic policies, a discovery that could lead to a cure for MS.
We see someone who is unqualified and unfit to be president of the United States.
It's all right here on today's International Edition. And we begin with the U.S. presidential campaign. Donald Trump's campaign is seeking to deflect criticism of his now defunct real estate seminars with testimonials from two former students who have business ties with the presumptive Republican presidential nominee. The campaign Wednesday posted a video defending Trump University after a federal judge unsealed documents in a long-running lawsuit filed by ex-students who claim they were conned. And at a rally in California Wednesday, Hillary Clinton leapt on the parallels to cast Trump as someone who peddles false promises to Americans but cares only about his personal gain.
This is just more evidence that Donald Trump himself is a fraud. He is trying to scam America the way he scammed all those people at Trump U. It's important that we recognize what he has done, because that's usually a pretty good indicator of what he will do.
The Trump seminars ended in 2011 amid a flurry of complaints and state fraud investigations. Now let's turn to what's trending on social media. And for that, we turn to VOA's Michael Lippin. Interesting, Michael, I hear the incoming president of the Philippines is getting attention for comments he made about his country's journalists. Exactly what did Rodrigo Duterte say?
Hi, Lori. Well, Duterte was speaking at a press conference in his hometown of Davao in the southern Philippines on Tuesday when one of the reporters asked him how he would handle the killings of journalists in the country. It's such a big problem that the Philippines is actually the second deadliest country in the world for journalists right now. That's according to data compiled by the international media rights group, the Committee to Protect Journalists. Now, Duterte won his country's presidential election last month in part due to campaign promises to wipe out crime by ordering security forces to kill criminals if necessary. So, in keeping with that tough talk, when asked about recent murders of journalists, he said many of them were corrupt. He also said that just because you're a journalist, you are not exempted from assassination if you are a... And then he used a derogatory expression, which I won't repeat here.
Wow. How did Philippine journalists react on social media to this?
Well, the National Union of Journalists of the Philippines used its Facebook page to say nothing justifies the murder of journalists. It also accused Duterte of declaring an open season for the Philippines to silence individual journalists and the media as a whole due to what it called the mere perception of corruption. And the National Union of Journalists of the Philippines also posted statements from other media rights organizations and activists expressing outrage at Duterte's remarks. In response to those posts, some Facebook users, though, defended the incoming president. Chris Santos wrote, "Freedom of speech isn't what Duterte was talking about in the press conference. He was saying, you reap what you sow." And Santos added that you should listen to Duterte's comments in their entirety before labeling him a psychopath. And another user, Ronald Jacosalam, had this to say, "Journalism in the Philippines is a big business, and some journalists will try to make their work appear very catchy to the reading public so that their reader base will increase." Jacosalam wrote that Duterte was asked a question whose premise was that journalists are like saints and flawless. So the president-elect responded by saying that not all journalists are as such. So you have a variety of views there, Lori.
All right. Thanks so much, Michael. You can follow him at Michael_Lippin. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Here are some of the other stories we're following at VOANews.com. A shooting at UCLA in Southern California as we look at Americans and guns. Kenya's annual rhino charge raises a record $1.4 million for conservation. And could Kenya be headed for talks on electoral reform? A new poll finds most Americans unhappy with the presidential campaign. And a baby born to a Zika-infected mom in New Jersey has microcephaly. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The United States is taking more actions to cut off North Korean access to the U.S. financial system, calling the North a primary money laundering concern. U.S. banks and other financial concerns are already barred from directly doing business with the North, but these steps would actually require them to be extra vigilant by keeping banks in third countries from gaining access to the U.S. system on North Korea's behalf. Now, State Department officials say the North uses state-controlled financial institutions and front companies to hide transactions that support building weapons of mass destruction. Meanwhile, I talked to Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb, who took an in-depth look at one of America's greatest deterrents to those who might use weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing. I got to go on a nuclear submarine that is fueled by a nuclear reactor and carries these Trident II payloads, which are about four stories high, and they can be launched from the sub to hit pretty much anywhere thousands of kilometers away. It's pretty impressive. The submarine itself is a very special sub. It's called the Ohio-class submarine. It's about 171 meters long, also four stories high. It can completely submerge underwater. So that's what makes it so interesting, because the United States enemies do not know where it is at any given time, and it can just kind of disappear off the radar, so to speak. And with all of these nuclear weapons, there can be up to two dozen on the sub at any given time. It's what a lot of officials are calling the foremost part of the nuclear triad for the United States defense.
And for those who don't know, what exactly is the nuclear triad?
So the nuclear triad is what a U.S. Defense Department calls the military's ability to attack by land, by sea, or by air. And so by land, that's the intercontinental ballistic missiles that are positioned across the United States in different areas. By air, we've got the jets that can carry these bombers, that can take nuclear weapons and drop them in the air. And then we've got by sea, of course, this is the submarine aspect. And there's only a few of these. There's 14 of the submarines now. They're on both the East Coast and the West Coast, like the USS Alaska that I went on when I was down in Georgia. And they basically just patrol, and they can go. They have a life of about 20 years before they have to be refueled. But the hulls of the ship only last so long. They only last about 40 years. And that's why officials were telling me, we've got to start doing what we need to do to get these replaced, because when the hulls run out and we don't have anywhere to store and move these missiles, we're losing one of the very important parts of the nuclear triad, and that lessens our defense. So we've got to get this fixed now so it will be ready in the future when these hulls run out.
You talk about the fleet aging and needing to be replaced. Is there a concern that there won't be funding for that?
There is a concern. There is money for this replacement program, some funding, in the current budget. But we don't know if that budget is going to get passed or not, first and foremost. And secondly, Congress has a tendency to pass big problems down. We say kick the can down the road here in the United States. And this is one of those things that cannot wait until one large bill, because the United States is not going to be able to afford it. It's not just the submarines that need to be replaced. There's the entire triad. There's the airplanes that are carrying these things. There's the intercontinental ballistic missiles that need to be updated as well. So instead of waiting until the very last minute for all of this, what the Navy is saying is that we've got this problem. We know how to solve it. We need to start working on this now, because it's going to take a few years just to build it. So if you give us the funding now, we can start building so we'll have something to host these missiles in the future. Now, that's very contentious with the rest of the Department of Defense, because, of course, as soon as the Navy mentioned that, and the Air Force, of course, said, we want to be on that bill, too. Can't you include some funding for the Air Force so we can get our stuff updated? So it's very difficult to get any of this done, but it has been done before. There have been funding for different operations across the globe, Iraq, Afghanistan. That's what the Navy is saying needs to happen with the nuclear program, because if not, it's going to keep getting pushed and pushed until it's going to be too late.
Right. And of course, when we continue to see situations like what is unfolding in North Korea, it seems more important than ever to continue with this program.
Absolutely. And Captain Greg Hicks, who is the spokesman for General Joe Dunford, who is the top general in the military, said that this was the most important weapon that the United States has. Our ability to launch nuclear weapons anywhere, anytime, to hit anything if we were attacked is crucial. They also want to stress that this is a deterrent. This is not something to go out and bully other countries. That's never the use for these weapons. They've always been a use to protect the United States from attack from somebody else who has a nuclear weapon, because it basically means, hey, you may have a nuclear weapon too, but if you try to attack us, the United States, the military says it's mutual destruction. You don't want to do that. And officials say that that prevents people from acting, because they have to think twice. And North Korea would definitely think twice, because they would know that if any sort of thing went toward the United States, the entire area, Pyongyang, would be gone.
All right, you can read much more on this fascinating story at voanews.com. There's been a possible break in the search for the Egypt Air black box. Egyptian aviation officials say a French ship picked up signals likely emitted from the black boxes of the plane that crashed in the Mediterranean last month. VOA's Victor Beatty talked about this development with Thomas Anthony, Director of Safety and Aviation Security at USC.
They can be confident because the signal is of a specific frequency and so it's identified as being from the pinger. However, it is only really just one source of data that is going to help them locate that wreckage. One of the things that people miss is that there is on every commercial aircraft, what's called an emergency locator transmitter (ELT), which sets off a radio signal on impact. So, and it is received by satellites. So that signal was received, it's reported. So that has helped to identify the area for search. And while the flight data recorder and the cockpit voice recorder maintain data of a digital nature, the signal that is used to transmit them is a real sound. It is a sonic signal. It's not like a radio signal, so it can be heard. The problem with that is that if there are thermoclines, namely different layers of water based upon temperature, if there are thermoclines, then that makes the whole thing a lot more difficult, because sort of like sonar in reverse, that causes the sonic signal to bounce. So that becomes a real problem with deep water. While we can frequently depend upon the information on the cockpit voice recorder and the flight data recorder, it's important to recognize that there is additionally on modern aircraft what's called a quick access recorder that is downloaded. It is a subset or a subprocessor of the flight data recorder that is downloaded almost on a daily basis, so that the aircraft operator can monitor the condition of the aircraft. And it's important that we recognize that there are different parts of the aircraft will contain data, just like subsets of that flight data recorder. And similarly, while we're looking for that flight data recorder and cockpit voice recorder, there may be a single part, as in the case of Alaska Flight 261, which crashed off the coast of Southern California here. There may be a single part that really contains the key to determining what happened. That being said, even a single piece that is very telling probably will not tell why it happened.
How possible is it to retrieve it at that depth? How long might it take? And what condition will it be under such water pressure?
The cockpit voice recorder and the flight data recorder are tested to the most grueling and exacting standards. So they are tested at very low temperatures, very high temperatures, very high pressures. And so I think we can assume that they will be, if they can be retrieved, that they'll be in operational condition.
The Egypt Airbus A320, by the way, was traveling from Paris to Cairo when it suddenly crashed, killing all 66 people on board. No terror group has claimed responsibility. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
National Edition continues. President Obama returned to Elkhart, Indiana Wednesday to dispel what he says are Republican myths that his policies are bad for the economy. The Midwestern city was the first city Obama visited as president in 2009 when Elkhart's unemployment rate was 19%. It is now down to 4%, and Obama credits what he says are smart decisions by his administration and Congress to create jobs across the country.
7.5 years since I first came here, we've got to challenge the assumptions behind this economic story.
Meanwhile, a new jobs report is due out this week, which could offer more positive argument for positive, further positive his argument. Let's talk about it with, if I can speak, with VOA economic reporter Jim Randall. Jim, what should we look for?
We're expecting on Friday at 8:30 in the morning Eastern Time, we expect that the unemployment rate will drop very slightly from 5% to about 4.9%. That number comes from a group of economists who are surveyed by the Bloomberg Financial News Service, as they do every month. And they tend to be more or less right much of the time. And also, the same group predicted that there'll be a net gain of about 158,000 jobs across the entire U.S. economy. Now, we're going to lose a couple of million jobs. We're going to gain a couple million and then some. So then the difference between what we lose, what we gain, will be about 158,000, according to these very smart people who are often right.
There's been a lot of talk lately, particularly in the political arena, about how the economy is really starting to slow up, that it's not really, it isn't as good as it looks when it comes to jobs.
You know, I think a lot of people don't look at the data. The data says that the unemployment rate dropped from a high of 10% to its current level of 5%, which is pretty close, according to Economics 101, that's pretty close to full employment. So and they're saying, oh, the numbers are the government's cooking the books and so forth. I kind of doubt that. I mean, there are some pretty thoughtful, responsible people working on these things. I don't think they get it all right all the time, but I know they try pretty hard.
And we've got some other news regarding consumer spending.
Consumer spending went up, and that's important. Consumer spending went up a full percentage point, and in my little world, that's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important because consumer demand drives about 70% or 67% or 70%, depends on who you ask. But the point is, most of it is driven by demand from consumers. So when consumer demand goes up, economists smile, investors are happy, and the economy tends to expand.
So we're spending money.
We're spending money. We're buying things. When you buy stuff, somebody's got to make the stuff you just bought, or they've got to create the services you just purchased. And that means jobs. And that's what's creating the U.S. economy. The thing is that China, for example, is switching from a mostly manufacturing, export-driven economy. They can't do that forever. They are reaching the upper limits of mm-hmm. how much that's going to work. And so they're trying to shift in a very sensible way from mostly manufacturing to a more diverse, more knowledge-based, and hopefully for their people, a little more rewarding financially thing. But there's lumps and bumps there. It's been a tough transition for them, and that's slowed demand from China for all of their trading partners, including the United States, and that's caused some worries and consternation. But probably in the long term, the IMF and the World Bank, people like that, say it's a good thing. It's the right thing to do. They're just having a tough time working out the details.
And with the, you know, good economic reports coming out, that makes it even more likely that we will see a key interest rate hike. Is that not true?
We'll find that out on the 15th of this month when Janet Yellen and her colleagues from the Federal Open Market Committee, what that means is the big wigs at the U.S. Central Bank, mm-hmm. will get together mm-hmm. and discuss and debate and fuss and fume and figure out for 2 days whether or not they should raise interest rates. They raised them a little bit last December, and they were at a quarter in a range from 0 to 0.25%, which is vanishingly small. Now they're up to about 0.5%, which is almost vanishingly small. And so the big deal is they might raise them to 0.75%. I mean, big
so
whoop. That's a technical term.
They're doing it gently.
It sends a message. When mm-hmm. you make it less expensive to borrow money, you make it easier for people to buy things and buy houses, to buy factories, to buy machines, to buy the stuff that helps the economy mm-hmm. expand. So if you want to get the economy to grow, one of the things you could do is lower interest rates. But if you keep interest rates too low for too long, you could overstimulate the economy, you could get inflation, and your money would be worth less, or if it happens too hard, too fast, too long, it would be worthless. So they're keeping an eye. The Fed has two jobs. One is to try to have full employment, and they're pretty close to that. And the other is to maintain stable prices, and they define stable prices as inflation at about 2%. We know how to deal with inflation. We don't know how to deal with deflation, and so they're worried that the economy could slip into deflation, and that would cause all kinds of difficulties.
All right. Well, let's turn to some entertainment news now. Social media star Andrea Russett has more than 2.5 million subscribers on her YouTube channel, but her fans weren't sure what was real and what was pretend when they watched her Snapchat feed. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, Russett and her friends shot a Snapchat movie that included going on a camping trip and ended in a horrifying nightmare.
Is that the Sick House website?
You're really gonna go.
Are you gonna tell us the story?
There's the three rules. Don't make any noise.
You hear that?
Never go inside.
Don't be nervous.
And you always leave a gift on the porch.
The film is called Sick House, and it was shot in real time using iPhones over a period of 5 days. It was then published on Andrea Russett's Snapchat feed. The film follows a group of friends obsessed with social media as they go camping in the woods and decide to explore an abandoned, haunted cabin. Russett says that she didn't tell everyone that her Snapchat feed was part reality, part fiction, and that had some of her friends concerned.
I actually, when doing the whole project, I didn't tell a lot of my friends what I was doing because I wanted to see their genuine reactions and see if they believed that this was real and happening. And I got so many of my friends texting me being like, oh my God, thanks for the invite for camping. Like, I would have loved to gone. Or like another girl texted me and she was like, are you okay? Like, I haven't heard from you in a few days and your Snapchat is getting me worried.
Because Snapchat posts are deleted after 24 hours, the clips had to be compiled to make a full-length feature. But Russett says that acting for Snapchat had its own challenges.
At first, I wasn't acting as a character. I was being myself because it was my Snapchat. So we had to start off being very much myself and then gradually becoming this other character. So that was kind of interesting to take it from literally being myself to someone else without people really noticing, I guess. And yeah, the whole like one take type thing. We could obviously do it a few times, but you do it once. And then if you really like that take, but you're like, we could do it better, you can't like save it and go back, you know? So that was a little tricky, but we made it work.
Guys, there's someone in the house. Did you see that?
Did the door just slam? The door
did anybody else see that?
But me?
We're going home right now. We're leaving. We're going home right now.
We're not going anywhere. It's pitch black out.
Where the hell is the car?
Andrea Russett says it was exciting to take part in the project, but she doesn't think that Steven Spielberg or J.J. Abrams have much to worry about from social media movie moguls, at least not yet.
I don't think people are ever going to lose interest in watching, sitting down and watching a movie, you know, but I think it's interesting to try out these new different things. Like, would it work better if we sat and watched it like 10 seconds on Snapchat, then like a half hour later, 10 more seconds? It's interesting to explore it, but I don't think it's ever going to become where people don't want to sit down and watch a movie.
If you would like to see the full version of Sick House, it's available online, of course, at Vimeo. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
That's going to do it for this edition of International Edition. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. And you can find us anytime at voanews.com or follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Follow me at Lori London. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Zubair El Tayeb. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Law enforcement and the rule of law in Pakistan got a boost recently with some assistance from the United States. Last month, U.S. Ambassador to Pakistan David Hale and Pakistan Economic Affairs Division Secretary Tariq Bajwa signed a one-year $48.6 million bilateral assistance agreement. Under the agreement, the U.S. Department of State's International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs Bureau will provide support to the government of Pakistan in building Pakistan's law enforcement capability, fighting illicit narcotics, and strengthening its criminal justice system. The United States signed the first such bilateral assistance agreement in 1982. Subsequent yearly agreements have supported the training of tens of thousands of police officers and prosecutors, construction of police stations, and provision of vehicles, equipment, and life-saving personal protective gear for law enforcement agents. The new agreement will fund several programs throughout Pakistan, including initiatives to improve the capability and reach of provincial police and other law enforcement institutions through training, equipment, and infrastructure support. Programs will also support women's access to the justice system, as well as support the recruitment, retention, and advancement of women as police officers, prosecutors, and judges. In addition, programs will help Pakistan interdict illegal narcotics, arrest and prosecute drug traffickers, fund crop substitution and agricultural training programs for poppy farmers, and provide small-scale irrigation, hydroelectric systems, and farm-to-market roads in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province and the federally administered tribal areas. Lastly, it will promote rule of law by providing training to provincial and federal prosecutors and judges in effective trial advocacy and to corrections officials in modern prison administration. The Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs works in more than 90 countries to help them combat crime and corruption, counter drug-related crime, improve police institutions, and promote laws and court systems that are fair and accountable. The United States is proud to work with its partner, Pakistan, to support a criminal justice system that serves and protects the people of Pakistan.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.